Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, another rare show of bipartisan agreement on Capitol Hill. Both the House and Senate overwhelmingly approved the 21st Century Cures Act, which has earmarked billions of dollars for biomedical research, providing money for mental health and addiction services, Alzheimer's, and cancer research, and accelerates the drug approval process through the FDA.
It's being touted as a landmark piece of legislation, securing much-needed funds for the National Institutes of Health. But very importantly, it also secures the $1 billion the president had requested to help fight the opioid crisis.
But the bill is not without some controversy, Margaret. Critics like Senator Elizabeth Warren claim it's too lenient on the pharmaceutical industry. And while the Cures bill secures almost $5 billion for research, the funds must still be approved and appropriated by members of Congress. And that's often an uphill battle.
And of particular note in this bill, Mark, is the support that it provides for mental health services. Now, mental health advocates call this bill the most important piece of legislation since the passage of the Mental Health Parity Act in 2008. This bill does do a lot to improve access to mental health services and training for the people who provide them, and hopefully that's going to help fill a huge gap in care.
President Obama saying this bill will generate momentum in research, investing nearly $3 billion to build upon the major initiatives already launched in his administration. And speaking of those research initiatives, that's something our guest today is quite passionate about.
Dr. Victor Zhao is the president of the National Academy of Medicine at the National Academy of Sciences, and we look forward to that conversation.
And also, Laurie Robertson stops by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you. Now, we'll get to our interview with Dr. Victor Zhao in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Drug prices through the roof. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services has been analyzing the trend of rising drug prices, trying to get a handle on what's behind these spikes and who the biggest offenders are. According to the report, the drug with the biggest rise in cost per unit in Medicare Part D from 2014 to 2015 was Losartan potassium, a generic version of the hypertension drug Cozaar, rising just under 500% from 2014 to 2015. In third place, lisinopril, the generic of the ACE inhibitor Zestril, that rose over 400%. Cancer drugs also saw a dramatic rise from 2011 to 2015. Speaking of cancer, folks on Medicaid often get subpar treatment when diagnosed with it. That, according to a survey of cancer patients by the not-for-profit Cancer Support Community, found Medicaid beneficiaries with cancer more often felt their doctors rushed through their appointments, more likely experienced delays in getting appointments, were least likely to receive social and emotional support services, and more likely to say they only sometimes got the coverage they needed. One key reason for the disparity is that Medicaid benefits vary from state to state. Meanwhile, a group of healthcare leaders have gotten together to urge the Trump administration to continue to support the healthcare industry's move towards value-based care. The Healthcare Transformation Task Force is a consortium of heavy hitters from across the healthcare spectrum. They sent their urgent message to Trump, his Vice President Mike Pence, and congressional leaders from both parties, urging them to refrain from undermining gains made from streamlining healthcare with a focus towards value and outcomes versus volume. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Victor Zhao, president of the National Academy of Medicine, formerly the Institute of Medicine, a private nonprofit institution providing objective analysis and policy advice to solve the nation's complex problems related to science, technology, and medicine. Dr. Zhao most recently served as chancellor for health affairs at Duke University and president and CEO of Duke University Medical Center, where he launched the Duke Translational Medicine Institute and the Duke Global Health Institute. Prior to that, he was chairman of Harvard's Medical School, Brigham and Women's Hospital, and also served as chairman of the Department of Medicine at Stanford University. Dr. Zhao is a renowned researcher whose work led to the development of ACE inhibitors, now used widely for treatment of high blood pressure. Dr. Zhao earned his medical degree from McGill University Medical School in Montreal. Dr. Zhao, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's a great pleasure to be talking to you.
Your appointment at the National Academy of Medicine came at a very interesting inflection point in healthcare. Your background in translational science speaks to the emerging reality of modern healthcare, which increasingly is becoming an interdisciplinary partnership. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners how that background is shaping the direction that you're leading the Academy through during this time of transformation in healthcare.
Well, Mark, I would say there's never a more exciting but challenging time in science, medicine, and healthcare. If you look at the advances in science and technology, they're breathtaking. Genome sequencing for $1,000, mm-hmm. precision medicine, stem cell, regenerative medicine, gene editing. And yet, the world is facing unprecedented challenges in, say, increased disease burden, such as obesity, diabetes, emerging infections like Zika and Ebola, antimicrobial resistance, and of course our healthcare system is fragmented and really too expensive. The National Academy of Medicine has been around for about 50 years, and we found our roots in the National Academy of Science, which was chartered by Abraham Lincoln and Congress to be independent advisors to a nation. Mm-hmm. We must continue to be that evidence-based, trusted advisor and independent from politics or any kind of non-science beliefs. And so we have asked ourselves to be more innovative, more action-oriented. And, you know, we have recently redone our mission statement to say our job is to improve health for all mm-hmm. and to accelerate progress in science, medicine, and policy, but address health equity issues. That's what I hope to bring to National Academy of Medicine.
I look back at the work that you've done. You've served at the helm of a number of the nation's premier medical institutions. Most recently were at Duke, before that at Harvard and Stanford. And you oversaw just a tremendous amount of transformation at Duke, launching both the Global Health and the Translational Science Institute. What did you learn accelerating change at the academic level that's going to inform the work being undertaken at the National Academy of Medicine?
What I've learned in my journey, including my journey through Harvard, Stanford, and Duke, is, of course, it's really important to take a step back and ask ourselves, what exactly are we trying to accomplish? What are we all about? And it is about doing good for society. So one must first articulate your vision and create a very clear strategy going forward, which is, in fact, what we're doing right now, as we have recently reconfigured ourselves to become the National Academy of Medicine. You know, the recent reorganization of the National Academies. We are the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine, three academies under the same roof. It's about collaborating across disciplines and creating a culture that really fosters innovation and evidence-based so that people can trust us, that what we say are based on facts and the very best minds.
Well, you mentioned earlier a concern about the sort of partisanship that's been happening. I think we're all buoyed by the passage of the 21st Century Cures Act. As you contemplate the new administration, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about their commitment to the advancement of biomedical research.
I'm cautious but optimistic. Mm-hmm. 9 months ago, we anticipated, of course, a change in U.S. administration. Mm-hmm. And so we started this initiative called Vital Directions for Health and Healthcare. Dr. Mark McClellan co-chaired this with me. As you know, he was the previous FDA commissioner and CMS director. He's a Republican. And two of us put together a steering committee of really notable individuals who understand health, but also understand policy and government. We have people like Mike Leavitt mm-hmm. and Tom Daschle. Really, in mm-hmm. many ways, I would say nonpartisan, not even bipartisan.
Right.
And we said, look, it's about what the country needs going forward. And so we worked on policies and actions that can yield timely and measurable progress. And we have three key goals: better health and well-being, high-value healthcare, and strong science and technology. We brought together 150 experts to guide us, and we had a big summit. And right now we are synthesizing all these pieces together so that we can give to the administration seven very clear priorities that they need to consider going forward. And so I do think there's a real opportunity to work together with the new administration to look at what's ahead of us and what we must do together to improve health of the nation.
I know, Dr. Zhao, that you also have a very significant focus on global health, and you warned that global pandemics could cost the global economy some $6 trillion. What does the National Academy of Medicine recommend as the more sound approach to meeting these global pandemics?
You know, what happens in a far corner of the world can rapidly affect us, you know, be it pandemics, war, security, refugees, climate change, and we have to lead. You know, certainly we are all together trying to improve the planet. Everything is hyperconnected. Health influences economy, it influences national and global security. That's what our report said. I think that the decision makers understand that if we stand on the sideline and we don't invest enough in health, we may end up with negative impact on the economy and security. Take, for example, Ebola. During the outbreak, borders were closed, people stopped traveling, lives were lost, and the impact was huge. In our report, when we assessed the loss per year by pandemics in the world, is $60 billion. Mm. So the trillion numbers to say, if you imagine this for a century, and when SARS hit Hong Kong, the airport was literally shut down,
right,
and they lost a lot of money. But I think security is the other issue. Think about the security issue in terms of borders and people moving one to the other. And think about the world now, which these pathogens can be used as weapons. Our report basically highlighted the importance of health in a connected fashion to everything else. You know, we put that much money into homeland security, into military, and to cybersecurity. We got to put money into health security.
We're speaking today with Dr. Victor Zhao, president of the National Academy of Medicine. Dr. Zhao, as I hear you speak about the work and the mission of the National Academy of Medicine, you stand on the shoulders of so many tireless, dedicated volunteers. And one of the memorable reports was your 1999 report to Air is Human, which shined a spotlight on one of medicine's most concerning shortcomings, the high rate of deaths related to medical errors. And it's now been 17 years since that initial report, and the numbers still remain unacceptably high. And I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners about the work that's been done and chart some of the strategies that you have going forward.
First of all, you mentioned the word volunteer. I do want to talk about that. We have some 2,000 Academy members who are being elected every year, leading scholars and experts in health and science and medicine. I think we have something like 50 Nobel laureates, so that we have the best minds in engineering and economy, et cetera. So this report, To Air is Human, is an example of the contribution that we can make. 17 years ago, I remember this report that says, you know, up to 90,000 U.S. citizens can die from preventable deaths in the hospital, and it's from errors, and that was a wake-up call. In the last 17 years, the world has gone on a journey of understanding how important it is to say quality is important, safety is important. People are going to make mistakes. However, if we have a system and a culture of patient first, quality of care, safety of care, that system should greatly reduce the error that people can make inadvertently. As you know, I was at Duke, and we had some infamous cases of patient safety problems.
Right.
We learn a huge amount. We have to have a culture where people say, if I see something that's not right, I can speak up and there'll be no retribution. So if I look back on 17 years, I'll say that the impact is enormous, you know, from almost like a dark ages to where we are today, using now, of course, technological tools to report, to track. And we're able to collect much better numbers than we collected 17 years ago. I'm sure you followed that ARC 2016 reported the data showing that some of the changes they put in place, particularly in terms of measuring hospital performance, have greatly reduced errors and saved lives and saved money. So we're going to be vigilant and keep doing better.
Well, Dr. Zhao, another area where we admire and follow the National Academy of Medicine is in its commitment to fostering workforce development. So as you know, the Academy released a lauded, groundbreaking report, The Future of Nursing, several years ago. They followed up with a report just about a year ago, I think, looking at progress on those recommendations. Can you address that initiative and how the National Academy of Medicine is working to advance that cause?
When I was at Duke, I was responsible for the nursing school as well, and the medical school and the hospitals. And I see the centrality of nursing in frontline, but also in education and research. And in fact, if you look at our report, it's the most downloaded report ever.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And I think what this report really said was we have to have nurses practice the full extent of their education training and not the old days where, you know, they are just to serve the doctors, particularly when you think about what they can do and how compassionate and capable they are, and the fact that we have shortage of physicians, nurses should lead, should practice to full extent education. The report says they should have high levels of education because the evidence show the more educated the nurses are, the better the patient outcome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, their goals to say how many must obtain a baccalaureate degree, how many should get higher education, doctor of nurse practice and PhDs, etc. And the report says they should be full partners with physicians and other healthcare providers, and they should become involved with effective workforce planning. Shortly after release report, RWJ launched this Future of Nursing campaign for action,
mm-hmm.
which they say, how to implement all those recommendations? So we have certainly seen changes in states that remove major barriers and given full practice authority to nurse practitioners. But let me say that it's not just nursing. It's interprofessional education. There's a recognition that we work around the patient and a team supporting the patient. Doctors, nurses, but also social workers,
mm-hmm.
pharmacists. Certainly when I was at Duke, we pushed for what we call interprofessional education, getting people from different professions to work together early during their training to learn to work as a team, working for the same purpose, which is improve care for the patient.
Dr. Zhao, you were saying that we want to contribute to the health of our people and globally. And I was thinking about the work that's happening over at the NIH with their Precision Medicine Initiative, this Million Lives study that the president has been behind. Certainly the 21st Century Cures Bill is adding some money to it. Thoughts about genomics, that sort of intersection of medicine, science, and personalized health? Many of the ways they've tried to put this together is a sort of an interdisciplinary approach, trying to bring everybody to the table.
Right.
Some thoughts about that?
More than that, they bring patients to the table.
That's right.
Right?
Yes.
It's a big voluntary program where we want people to volunteer, being willing to share their DNA information, being willing to see that this is collectively where we can learn from engaging the patient population. So a big part of this is, in fact, engaging patients. You know, I think this Precision Medicine Initiative is one of the signature initiatives of President Obama. I certainly feel that he's been a great supporter of science and health. Look at some of the initiatives he's taken on in brain, precision medicine, and many other areas. As you all know, the promise of precision medicine is that we'll be able to develop the tools that can precisely identify the appropriate vulnerable individuals and very early intervene, if not find specific treatment. Sequencing human genome is only one part of information.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get a lot of other information to link them together. That includes all the omics technology, biomarkers, but also the data that you can collect from electronic health record, from the wearables, mm-hmm. biosensors, from big data. And because of these huge amount of scientific and clinical information, there's a long way to go to be able to collect them, to coordinate them, being able to analyze them, and to make useful information out of them. But importantly, we have to address, of course, patient privacy. We have to understand security of the data. So this initiative is really moving the whole nation forward for the future, and I'm very excited about this.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Victor Zhao, president of the National Academy of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences. You can learn more about their work by going to nam.edu. Dr. Zhao, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
What a great pleasure. Thank you very much.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The chairman of the Senate Environment Committee falsely claims that a new report confirms that hydraulic fracturing has not impacted drinking water in Wyoming. The report said a lack of water quality data predating oil and gas exploration prevented it from reaching, quote, firm conclusions. Senator James Inhofe, who chairs the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, made his remarks in a statement issued November 10, the day that the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality issued a report on water supply wells in Pavilion, a small town southeast of Yellowstone National Park. The industry-funded state report specifically looked at the likelihood of the impact of oil and gas operations on 14 water supply wells used by residents living near Pavilion. Since the 1990s, residents have complained of illnesses and said the drinking water was black and had a chemical taste. Inhofe said the state's investigation, quote, confirms what we've known all along. Hydraulic fracturing has not impacted drinking water resources. But that's not what the report said. Instead, the report said that it's, quote, unlikely that hydraulic fracturing had any impacts on water supply wells, but, quote, limited baseline water quality data predating development of the Pavilion gas field hinders reaching firm conclusions on causes and effects of reported water quality changes. The process of retrieving gas and oil, often from shale through fracking, entails injecting water, sand, and chemicals at high pressure, releasing oil and gas that would otherwise be difficult to recover. If water quality data had been collected before the drilling started, scientists could have compared that data with trends in the use of specific practices over the years. Both conventional and unconventional fuel recovery methods have the potential to negatively impact groundwater resources. And given the lack of baseline data, it's often difficult to confirm that fracking in particular has played a role in water contamination. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Diabetes is a chronic illness for which behavioral choices such as diet and exercise are extremely important. But incentivizing behavior change in large patient populations is very challenging. A recent study done by Emory University and a nonprofit organization focused on improving the health of India's population of 1 billion people found that text messages sent through smartphones might be a powerful tool in promoting diabetes prevention behaviors. They partnered with India's leading provider of mobile phones, Nokia, to harness a research cohort of 1 million clients to receive diabetes prevention text messages.
So the text messages themselves were developed with Emory University's Rollins School of Public Health because we wanted them based on science and behavior change theory. And then we adapted them with lots of consumer feedback.
Nalini Saligram, CEO of the Arogya Foundation, the text messaging study was designed to generate improved activity around 4 simple goals: consume more fruits and vegetables, avoid fried foods, and exercise regularly.
You know, the messages themselves were quite simple, but the sequence of the messages and how frequently they were texted was all based on behavior change theory as well as on Nokia's experience from their consumer base.
Participants who received just 2 text messages per week showed an average 40% more compliance with those activities than those who did not receive the messages. It could prove a useful tool for clinicians trying to affect behavior change across large patient populations. A low-cost targeted text messaging system sent directly to consumers, reminding them of the power they have to maintain simple lifestyle changes that can improve their chances of preventing or better managing diabetes and other chronic illnesses. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.